Peter B. Collins News and Comment. You are not paranoid. Even if you think somebody's watching you while you're standing in the shower. Lots of developments in the exposure of America's national surveillance state in the news in the last 24 hours, and we start with Glenn Greenwald's latest dispatch. He's been pretty quiet over at The Intercept, and some of that is the internal developments there. They've hired a new editor, and his name is John Cook. He says he's now recruiting more people to work there, if you're interested in taking some of Pierre Omidyar's billions. I continue to appreciate the work that Greenwald has done, and I continue to have some questions about the Omidyar aspect of it and others that I'll get to here in just a moment. But the latest revelations relate to a program that we've heard partly about before called Mystic, but Mystic grabs metadata. And we're going to develop a new term here called the full take. And full take is an NSA description of being able to grab all communications in a specific country. So in this lengthy report co-authored with Laura Poitras and one other reporter, Glenn Greenwald discloses that the nation of the Bahamas, which is a chain of islands southeast of the United States, is the first known, the first identified full-take country. And using a codenamed program called SOMALGET, I don't know who makes these up, S-O-M-A-L-G-E-T, SOMALGET records every wireless phone call in the Bahamas 24/7. And SOMALGET is now able to process over 100 million call events per day. Now, that's certainly more traffic than occurs in the Bahamas. And we have to step back here and say, okay, is the Bahamas just a beta test site for this NSA development program? Or is this mission creep? Because it's very clear that the islands of the Bahamas have not been involved in any form of terrorism. It's never been a haven for Al-Qaeda, even in any stretch of the imagination. And this gets into even murkier issues about the larger spy community. And I occasionally talk about this, that we've been so focused on the abuses of the NSA, and they are important, that we don't spend much time focusing on the 15 other intelligence tentacles that are arrayed under the Director of National Intelligence. And this leads us to the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, which has outposts in 80 countries. And they don't just collect intelligence on drug dealers, drug runners, and the narco trade. And their use of the NSA is something that we're just starting to scratch the surface on. So, how does NSA get into the telephone networks in the Bahamas and record every phone call every day? Well, they did it through the DEA. Because in the documents, they're explicit that they did not go to the Bahamian government and say, hey, do you mind if we record everybody's phone calls? You know, all these innocent residents of your islands? And it explicitly states that the NSA does not have approval of the Bahamian government. Now, the Bahamas isn't a real military threat to the United States, but if you imagine that on a larger scale, it could be highly problematic. So, I will link to Greenwald's story. It's a lengthy piece, very detailed. It is riddled with charts and some quotes from the Snowden cache of documents. And one of the interesting things is, in this chart, it shows that there are two nations that are named under the full take, and then they name three other nations, Mexico, Kenya, and Philippines, as being subject to full take of metadata. But there is an unnamed country that apparently is fairly large, because when I read between the lines here, Greenwald sneaks in the factoid that the NSA is able to capture a sufficient level of traffic that this is a medium-sized nation, could be on the size of Mexico or a little bit smaller. But Glenn Greenwald goes to some lengths to not mention that they're not naming that unnamed country. It's listed as unnamed, so it's quite obvious. And at one point, he says that they are not naming the contractor that facilitates these programs because of a credible threat of violence, which is explained no further. And this gets to the bigger picture here of Glenn Greenwald's role as being the judge and jury of what from Ed Snowden's cache of documents ultimately gets published. We know, going back to the original Promise program, that when the slides were revealed, they told us there were 40 or 45 of them, and we, to date, have seen less than a dozen. And this raises important questions about Glenn Greenwald as a gatekeeper. And I just completed reading his book last night, and the book adds some interesting detail. While it doesn't really advance the Snowden disclosures, the book is really a recap of many of the articles that Greenwald wrote for The Guardian and more recently at the online magazine The Intercept. The one real interesting scenario that he goes into detail about is how David Miranda, his husband, got caught up in the dragnet at Heathrow Airport, was detained for 9 hours, and the Brits got copies of some of the hard drives and thumb drives that David Miranda was traveling with. And at the time, many of us, including my friend and colleague Sibel Edmonds, said, whoa, what a stupid way to try to move that information. Well, now that we know more about that story, Laura Poitras was in Berlin, and there was one set of files that had been corrupted, and Greenwald couldn't get them to open at his headquarters in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And so they thought that the Guardian newspaper was going to supply a courier who would go to Berlin and take a flash drive to Rio de Janeiro to get the information to Greenwald. And at the last minute, the Guardian balked. And this is apparently where things went sideways between Greenwald and the Guardian newspaper. So the Guardian agreed to pay for Miranda's round-trip ticket. He flies to Berlin, spends a week with Poitras, and on the way back, clearly there had been a heads-up from the U.S. government to expect him at Heathrow, and that's when the proverbial shit hit the fan. So what is fascinating is that this occurred about the same time that the British spy agency GCHQ was cracking down on the Guardian. And you may recall last summer, there was a showdown where they went to the Guardian's offices and told them to either cough up the computers with the Snowden documents or destroy those computers in our presence. And the Guardian elected to do that. They say they went to the basement of the building, got out hammers, and just pounded the hell out of these hard drives and you know, pounded them into oblivion. Well, the part of the story that is just being told in Greenwald's book for the first time is that after that, the editor of The Guardian, I think his name is Rutzberger or something like that, he, without consulting Greenwald or Snowden or anyone else, gave full copies of all of the Snowden files to the New York Times. And this was a direct violation of the agreement that Greenwald had with Snowden. The last place he wanted his information to go was the New York Times, because he didn't trust them after what they had done to Risen's book, to Tom Drake, to the other NSA whistleblowers. And that appears to be the point where Poitras and Greenwald said, we can't trust the Guardian. And that's when they began to prepare their exit. Enter Pierre Omidyar, but Omidyar doesn't even get mentioned in Greenwald's book. And none of the issues that have been raised, legitimate questions about Omidyar, his tight relationship with Obama, the extent to which Greenwald's information acquired from Snowden is protected from Omidyar, these are legitimate questions. And they are not in any way addressed in Greenwald's book. So I want to again praise the work of Pando Daily, there at pando.com, and Yasha Levine, whom I've interviewed several times for the Processing Distortion podcast at Boiling Frogs Post. And Levine has had a chance to see the second installment of Frontline's two-part series, a total of 3 hours, about the NSA, built largely around the Snowden files. The final hour will be broadcast tonight, that is Tuesday, May 20th, on PBS stations. I know it'll be on 10 p.m. here in San Francisco. Yasha Levine at Pando got a screener ahead of time, and he says, I've just finished watching the second installment of the documentary. It's a great program that delves deep into Ed Snowden's NSA leaks and Silicon Valley's role in facilitating and enhancing the agency's internet surveillance operations. He says, really, the only complaint I have about the program is that it repeats the bogus claim that Ed Snowden was forced to stay in Russia only because the United States revoked his passport. We now know that that isn't true. A variety of Western and Russian sources, and he says, Levine, in parentheses here, I say this as someone who reads Russian, he's an emigre from Russia, indicate that Snowden has not been entirely honest about his Hong Kong escape story. The truth is that he had initially wanted to seek refuge in Iceland, but changed his mind and headed to Moscow instead because he thought it was the only place that had the power to rebuff America's extradition requests and guarantee his safety. Now, this is another part of the story that Glenn Greenwald doesn't delve into at all. He pretty well just skips over from Hong Kong and, oh yeah, now he's in Moscow. And so I give a lot of credit to Pando, to Levine, to Edmonds for asking critical questions here. And I would add to Levine's comment here, his only complaint is about the Snowden issues with Russia. The other big complaint that I mentioned last week after the first two-hour installment of the Frontline series is that they interviewed Bill Binney and Tom Drake, but they didn't allow them to talk about the contractor fraud, the revolving door at the NSA that brought people from contractors back into the agency, people from the agency over to run the contractors. It was incestuous and insidious, and that was completely excised from the Frontline special, and that bothers me. But what Levine focuses on in his latest article at Pando is that let me read this. He says, my experience in reporting his own series has gotten me used to being stonewalled by companies like Google, Facebook, Yahoo, and the rest. But surely they wouldn't have the balls to stonewall Frontline. Frontline? Well, he did. They did, and that's what he reports in this article. Not a single major internet company would comment, discuss, complain, or answer any questions about their role, witting or unwitting, in NSA's internet surveillance ops. In short, when contacted by PBS, the corporations we trust with our most private data and communications acted like evil tobacco or oil companies or shady crooks who had something to hide. And then he quotes Professor Hufnagel from UC Berkeley. The types of activities that Silicon Valley companies engage in are very similar to surveillance. It's surveillance just for advertising rather than law enforcement. And Levine goes on to describe Larry Page, co-founder of Google, as very concerned that people would figure out how evil Google is and how much of our information it collects. And I'm one of those people who's been to their campus on in Mountain View in Silicon Valley. And one of the things that struck me as very cool, you go into any building, and in the lobby behind the reception desk, there was a ticker, a screen up there, and it just kept listing recent searches at Google. And for a voyeur like me, it was fascinating to see all the different topics, unedited, unvarnished, what people ask for. And Levine quotes Page as saying, this is attributed to him, to Larry, the risks were too high. Once we squeezed the toothpaste out of the tube, we would not be able to put it back. And he would never do anything that might cost us access to what Wayne Rosen called our beautiful data. So the interests of the tech companies are not your interests and mine. And to see them ducking this fairly important approach to understanding the expansion and the unconstitutional behavior of the NSA begs their participation, and yet they begged off. Here in California, I want to commend Democratic State Senator Ted Lieu of Southern California. His bill was passed with just one dissenting vote in the state Senate yesterday, and it buttresses our Fourth Amendment rights. What it says is that the NSA may not engage in surveillance of Californians without a specific warrant. Now, while it wouldn't bar the NSA from continuing to spy, it will prohibit the state from participating in that surveillance or providing, quote, material support to the agencies involved. I love seeing that language, material support, because that's one of the vague terms that was developed by the Bushies in their dragnet efforts against terrorism. And material support is a very vague term. So to see it turned on the NSA gives me a kind of devilish pleasure. Now, they go on to say here that utilities owned by the state government wouldn't be able to provide water or electricity to NSA offices, state courts would not admit information gathered by the agency without warrants, and it wouldn't allow law enforcement officials in the state to assist federal agencies looking for records of phone calls, internet use, or other electronic activity by residents without a judge's warrant. Well, there are many legal challenges that will be raised if this bill ever becomes law. But at this point, it is a very important statement about our rights and a pushback from the state level against a creeping, expansive federal government. I want to thank the people who send me money every month and subscribe to support my podcast. People like Mona Kobus, Michael Petty, Jeffrey Gill, Kevin Beckley. They're all subscribers, and I would like you to join them. Come to my website at peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, there's a link that says sign up. You click on that. The next page gives you choices. $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Best deal is our $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the U.S. get themselves some bonus gifts, like a copy of John Dist's music CD called Red Flag. And while it lasts, a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans from our friend Russ Archibald on the big island of Hawaii. Well, tell me if this sounds the least bit credible to you. All right? The Central Intelligence Agency, which is known worldwide as the most duplicitous, least trustworthy organization, has announced, in reaction to the protests in Pakistan, where we had people pose as vaccinators, a vaccine team, in order to try to get DNA samples from the kids who were living in the compound where we thought Osama bin Laden was, near Abbottabad. Now, as a result of the pushback from that, a White House official has promised that the CIA will never again use vaccination programs as a cover for spying. Now, who's going to believe this? And, of course, at the CIA, no matter what anybody says, no matter what the law says, no matter what the presidential executive directives are, they do whatever they want. They worry about the consequences later, and they deny, deny, and deny. And if that doesn't work, they try to off the people who might inconveniently have information that contradicts that. So here's the official statement. The Director of Central Intelligence directed in August 2013 that the agency make no operational use of vaccination programs, which includes vaccination workers. Similarly, the agency will not seek to obtain or exploit DNA or other genetic material acquired through such programs. The CIA policy applies worldwide and to U.S. and non-U.S. persons alike. Trust me. That's what they're saying. Trust me. This is the agency that participated in MKUltra, dosing unsuspecting people, including an entire town in France, with LSD. This is the agency that participated in the efforts to develop various kinds of medical chemical weapons, biological weapons. And if you don't believe me, read the incredible, well-documented book by H.P. Alborelli called A Terrible Mistake. It pulls back the screen on MKUltra and related programs in a way that nothing else, no other book or publication ever has for me. Well, even Jon Stewart is turning on Barack Obama and Eric Shinseki. The scandalous treatment of our veterans, the shoddy operations at the Veterans Administration, have finally reached a fever pitch. Now, I have to say that when the New York Times tries to tell us that President Obama has a lack of awareness about the current problems at the VA, I find that hard to believe. Because everybody knows about the huge backlogs at veterans' hospitals, about the colossal problems that they have in serving the veterans who deserve, lifetime health care. So Jon Stewart opened his show last night, and due to a TiVo glitch, I didn't get to see it. But the New York Times quoted it as part of the... I think this is interesting how a fake news show becomes a barometer for attitudes in the country. Mr. Stewart on Monday lashed out at Mr. Obama and his top officials for not doing enough to fix the problem. And he mocked the president's top officials, including Eric Shinseki, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, for their tepid expressions of outrage and anger in recent days. Reacting to Shinseki's declaration that he was mad as hell about the allegations, Stewart ranted that, "You don't look mad. Your mad as hell face looks a lot like your, oh, we're out of orange juice face." And unfortunately, saving face is what all this will boil down to, because whether Shinseki is fired or not, these are long-term problems, and fundamentally Congress doesn't dish up enough money for the Veterans Administration to deal with the backlogs, to properly staff, to meet the needs of our veterans, and the needs are only going to grow in the future. And it's pathetic that Congress will allocate an extra $69 million for an unnecessary prison wing at Guantanamo and shortchange our vets. And the blame, while I'm not trying to let Obama or Shinseki off the hook, the blame really should be laid at every elected official in our nation's capital. Now, yesterday, I reported on one of the big, flashy indictments announced by Attorney General Eric Holder. And that was the indictments of five Chinese military officials for spying on U.S. companies. And it was really a ridiculous grandstanding move because it includes orders or requests to extradite these five Chinese military officers to face trial in the United States. And can you imagine if China tried to do the same to James Clapper, the proven liar? Or anybody in our intelligence community? Would we say, oh, yes, China, we think you'll give them a fair trial. Sure, we'll extradite these people to you pronto. So, on the heels of that, Holder announced a slightly more credible set of penalties and indictments against the Swiss bank Credit Suisse. And Credit Suisse, like other Swiss banks, manages bank accounts of Americans and others in a manner that is not disclosed. So I could have a bank account at Credit Suisse in Zurich, and they would not report it to the U.S. government. Now, yesterday, the announcement was that Credit Suisse is being fined $2.6 billion for aiding and abetting tax evasion by rich Americans. But none of those Americans were exposed or disclosed or named. And while the bank will pay this big fine, there are no executives who have been indicted, no senior executives. And of course, they'd rather cough up $2.6 billion, not actually their money, than face any kind of criminal penalties. And so Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan and chair of the Senate Finance Committee, I guess it is, or maybe it's, I'm not sure which committee investigated this. At any rate, he said, it's a mystery to me why the U.S. government didn't require as part of the agreement that the bank cough up some of the names of the U.S. clients with secret Swiss bank accounts. Some? How about all? So, we'll see if there is further action on that particular scandal. But hey, you know, banksters are a special breed. They'll shell out the cash, but they never go to jail. Pope Francis is on his way to the Holy Land later this week, and he's traveling with a couple of road buddies, a rabbi and an imam, a Muslim leader, both from his old country of Argentina, where he served as a cardinal before they named him Pope. And while he's going to try to spread some interdenominational understanding and call for peace, the real crisis is that Israel continues to slaughter Palestinians in cold blood. And yesterday, in two separate incidents in the same place, because there were Palestinians out protesting on Nakba Day, and Nakba is the day when they commemorate the destruction of scores of Arab villages that occurred as the Israelis took over and kicked out the Palestinians back in 1948. Now, there was a video taken from a security camera near the West Bank town of Ramallah. And these people were standing outside a prison where Palestinians are held indefinitely without charge. And there was a group of teenagers, and I watched the video carefully myself. Now, it could be selectively edited, but from what I saw, there's plenty of footage before and after each of these individual shootings. And these people were just standing around. They're in a shaded part under some sort of a roof or a canopy. And the bullets come from nowhere. The camera angle doesn't permit you to see where the shots came from. But these Palestinian teenagers who are just standing around, they're not threatening anybody, they're not throwing rocks or carrying weapons. They're just shot, and they crumble and die. And if the video was selectively edited, well, Israel's been doing that for years, and I really wouldn't fault the Palestinians for using some of the same techniques. We have reported to you about Pepe Escobar's deep analysis that was published at Tom Dispatch the other day about how the U.S. pivot to Asia and China's pivot toward Russia and Russia's pivot toward China are really taking the U.S. down a few notches in its economic and military stature around the world. And one of the predictions that Pepe made was that when Vladimir Putin visited Beijing and met with President Xi, that they would announce an agreement on a natural gas deal that would be conducted without the benefit of U.S. dollars. It would strengthen their bilateral trade and currencies and take the U.S. down still another notch. But because the Chinese don't have an immediate need for natural gas from Russia, they're driving a hard bargain. And Putin came all the way to China, and he visited Shanghai, and he visited Beijing, and he came back empty-handed because the Chinese don't want to pay the price that the Russians are asking. Now, I think that Pepe's analysis still holds, and that probably they will come to terms because the geopolitical benefits to them are even more valuable than a long-term gas supply deal. Yesterday, we updated you on the failed state of Libya, and the fact that Ross Douthat in the New York Times became, in my estimation, my experience, the first corporate media voice to mention that the whole plan that we participated in to first a no-fly zone and then taking out the Gaddafi government from Libya was stupid. And it's a big failure because we now have a chaotic situation with these different tribes vying for power. And Gaddafi had been able to suppress this intertribal rivalry in Libya. And despite who he was and all of the negatives, Libya was a prosperous state that was actually giving money away to African nations to help them deal with poverty and other issues. And so now we've got this guy named Hifter. It's not Hitler, but Hifter. And I don't know if you ever remember the Nostradamus predictions, but Nostradamus had a prediction about a guy named Hister who would arrive at about this time in history. I don't really believe in all that stuff, but it sticks in my memory. So anyway, this guy Hifter, who used to live down the road from CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, returned to Libya after we helped depose Gaddafi. And he's been trying to get a grip on power there. And he's taking a page from the generals in Cairo and trying to suppress the Islamic elements in Libya. But his opponents accuse him of seeking to grab power, acting on behalf of former government figures in exile by orchestrating an Egyptian-style military overthrow of Islamists that would wreck an already struggling attempt at democracy. So we've got chaos in Libya, and the Republicans just keep talking about Benghazi. In Bangkok, Thailand's army declared martial law in a surprise announcement before dawn today that it said was aimed at keeping the country stable after 6 months of sometimes violent political unrest. They went out of their way to say this is not a coup, but gosh, the generals in Cairo said it wasn't a coup last July 3rd, and the U.S. still sticks by that fantastical description of what occurred. So the military has taken over in Thailand before, and there is no doubt that things are pretty fluid and unpredictable there. We will continue to watch and see what goes on next in Thailand. And finally today, a letter from prison from our friend Don Siegelman, the former Democratic governor of Alabama, who's got his special suite in a federal prison in Mississippi, courtesy of Karl Rove. But the letter from Don Siegelman today is not about his own plight. He does note that there is an appeal underway, and he is looking forward, hoping that that will win his release. But he said, "Today I am writing on behalf of my friends here in prison." And he notes that the U.S. Sentencing Commission has voted to reduce sentences for some low-level nonviolent drug offenders. But what Don Siegelman is lobbying here for is that the reductions in sentencing be applied retroactively. And he is urging me to ask you to send an email or a letter to the U.S. Sentencing Commission in Washington, D.C. And I am going to post in the show file with this podcast a sample letter that was supplied by Governor Siegelman and the email and snail mail addresses for the U.S. Sentencing Commission. And if you won't do it for me, do it for Don Siegelman. Take a moment to pen a letter or an email and request that justice be done and that these draconian sentences be reduced retroactively. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. This podcast is free, and you are free to distribute it to absolutely everyone. With my thanks. Happy trails.